Since we're not going to have a sermonette, that gives me a little more time to cover the sermon. It's a big subject, and I thought it might be a helpful one for all that the congregation has gone through here lately. We've had a lot of sickness. We've had several people pass away. We've had, and it's just some sort of a hammering of the congregation, and that happens in almost every congregation I've ever been in. And there's a lot of things we can learn from that as we go through the process here of the journey of grief is what I've called it here. And it says, we have rarely, if ever, seen anyone come to a healthy resolution of grief by avoiding the pain. Well, where does this pain or grief or the word come from? Grief is natural after a loss. So grief is normal. And sometimes, all too many times in the church, we may tend to feel like, well, we're Christians. We know the truth. We shouldn't grieve when someone dies, whether it's a spouse. And this material that I'll be covering today is largely covering someone who's been widowed or a widower. But it can cover any loss. If you lost a child, a dear friend, someone you're close to, grief is a normal process. It's an important process that we all go through. And so a lot of the information I'm getting here today is from this book here, Getting on the Other Side of Grief. And one of the quotes in that book, I think, pretty well tells it. The contours of our grief, the contours of grief are unique for each person. There's various contours, if you will, that take place here. The different things that take place. Let me just read a little bit from this book. So by way of introduction, then we'll get into the scriptures as we do. First of all, let's ask ourselves, why does a church have to go through this kind of experience? We've lost loved ones. We've lost people that are dear friends. It hurts. And didn't God promise to heal when we were sick? We've all seen healings, and yet we've seen people die. What is this about? And what can we learn from this process? And just by way of introduction, so you'll think about it, I saw a big, big, important step in that process last Sabbath when we were honoring Melissa. And we'll talk about that in more detail, about what exactly was happening. Anyway, it reads here in this book, life ends, grief begins. When a spouse or a dear loved one dies, we have little choice but grieve. Some, usually men, pretend not to grieve, but for the most part, grief rolls out of out of the survivor like a torrent during the days and weeks following a death. When we ask why grieve in this particular chapter that I'm reading to you from, we're not suggesting that you ignore the onslaught of emotion, pain, and trauma that accompanies the death of a spouse or loved one. The question is, how intentional will you be in that process? So it's a process. We talk about how intentional. What do you do with the grief? And one of the first things you do is you don't deny the grief. Otherwise, you're really not beginning the proper way of the process. Can you or will you be grieving as a process that can lead to resolution? There's actually another side. You come out another side. Can you accept that grieving as a process that will help you live and love again? We've had people who've lost loved ones and went through the grieving process. They're not here because Mr. and Mrs. Hoosier are now, I believe, in Oklahoma or wherever it is, you know, our newlyweds, I call them. Both of them went through the grieving process of losing a loved one. They came out of the other side. They came out the other side stronger and in some ways more healthy than they were when they went into that process. So we'll go through this again in some more detail. One of the most important questions a widow or widower faces is, What is grief all about? You may not be inclined to face grief that analytically, but directly addresses the reality of being widowed is necessary for your emotional and mental health. Unless the grief process is confronted courageously, you won't arrive at a healthy resolution and be able to move on. If you don't address it directly, you run the risk of getting stuck in your grief for a long time. You know, when you lose a mate, some of you know what that's like. My wife lost a nephew who was 4 years old. That's really, really, really difficult. You see a casket this big, you know. And he was helping his daddy unload horses in the afternoon on the farm. And it's time to eat. And he said, I don't feel good. He says, I think I'll just lay down on the couch, just a little four-year-old. And he fell asleep and never woke up. He had spinal meningitis and no one knew it. That is a blow because he had no way to be prepared for it. He had no way to be prepared for it. And there were a lot of tears shed. And that's healthy. That's good. So we, all of us, have our traumatic periods in life. And if we face them in a healthy way, we grow from that process. And believe it or not, it makes you a better Christian. Makes you a better husband, a better wife, a better person all the way around. So there's many contours here. Where does pain come from? I'll be done here quoting this book, but by introduction, I think it's helpful. Where does pain come from? Grief is natural after a loss. That's important to remember. It is natural to grieve. It is a natural thing to grieve. But I thought Christians had faith, and Christians know that there's the resurrection, and Christians know that when Christ comes back, they're going to be resurrected, and we know they're not suffering anymore. Stop. All that's true. But we have to face the mourning process. There's a process for that. All that information I just said is helpful, but not right away. Most of the time it's not helpful right away. Most of the time if you find yourself with somebody who's in just in the throes of this early loss of a loved one, do not preach to them. Do not lecture them. The most important thing you can do is give them a hug if they'll accept that. Or hold a hand if they'll accept that. And if they're crying and they're angry, let them cry and let them be angry. It's a process they're going through, and you're helping them. And if you have gone through this process or are going through it now, when you come out the other side, you'll know what to do because you'll know what is important to do, what you needed. And you can now share that with others. The sense of loss itself was a source of much pain. Loss means that something or someone you cared about is no longer there. The more you loved or valued that person, the greater the pain. If you didn't love and care for that person, there would be very little pain. And this guy who has a PhD did a long study with taxpayer money and found that out. You know, if you don't know the person, you really don't feel any pain. What? I needed you to tell me that? But if you knew the person, bam. I remember Brian one time told me, he works in the emergency room, and he says there's nothing that compares to the cry, the moan of a mother who's just been told that their child has died. He says there's just no way to explain that. It's a deep, deep thing, especially for mothers. So how do we manage the pain in our life? What are these different contours we've been talking about? There we go. Okay. So we're going to talk about what is grief all about. Taking a passive attitude by summary of grief rarely works. You can't really be passive. You have to be deliberate. And it's okay for you to say, I'm in mourning right now, and I'm ticked off at God. What? Good Christians don't get mad at God. I'm sorry. Yes, we do. We all have gotten angry with God from time to time. We just don't want to admit it, because good Christians don't do that. Newsflash. You're not the first person that God has sensed you're mad at them. That's okay. That's part of the process. But you can go to God and say, look, I'm angry with you because I don't understand why this or that happened. I know you're perfect. I know you're a God of love. But I can tell you right now I'm not feeling it. Right now I'm angry with you. And I ask you to forgive me for that. But I know it's a process, and you know it's a process. Forgive me, be patient with me, and help me through it. So God isn't going to say, wow, I didn't know that. He knew it all along. And the healing part of that is we begin to understand it and accept it ourselves. So we can't be passive. Again, today's sermon is designed to face the pain of grief with purpose. We find that in Romans 8, 28. Romans 8, verse 28. This is from the Amplified Bible with notes. And we know with great confidence that God, who is deeply concerned about us, causes all things to work together as a plan for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. So we are called, and there's a purpose. And everything in our life, even though it may seem totally disconnected, there is a purpose to it. And it's all part of that plan. He is preparing sons and daughters to be in his family. That purpose, he will do whatever is required for us to get there. And I myself prefer the painless, no difficulty, no trial approach to becoming a child of God. However, that is not in the job description. It's just not in the job description. So we learn there's a purpose. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 13. Let me read to you here from, it's what's called the Expanded Bible. I won't read all of the expanded part of it, but you see a little bit of it here. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 13. Brothers and sisters, I want you to know and do not want you to be uninformed, or it says in the King James, ignorant, about those Christians who have died, i.e. those who sleep. It's, again, a euphemism for death. John 11, which we'll spend some time in, shows us that. So that you will not be sad as others who have no hope. Did it say you're not to be sad? Didn't say that. It says that you will not grieve, or you will not be sad as those who have no hope. So here, when we do know the truth about the resurrection, receiving a new body, we're going to see our loved ones again. That's where that comes in handy, doesn't it? That's where it comes in. It strengthens us. But that's something that as we go through a grief process, we will be reminded of, see it, and be comforted. But at first, we may just say, you know, that's just one of those real estate escape clauses, you know. But it's not. It's not. Now, the Greek word, I think it's a lipuso, or I don't know how to say it, 3706, for the word grieve means to be distressed, or effectively or passively, to be sad. So we're sad, we're grieved, we're in heaviness of spirit, if you will, but not like people who have no hope in the world. We do have the truth. And so that truth, and there's a time for us who will be trying to help folks. There's a time to say that, and there's a time not to say it. Remember what Ecclesiastes says? There's a time for everything, and there's a time to say it. This is why we call it, in the book here, calls it, it's a journey. We Christians are on a journey. And just like any journey, there's a lot of difficult times. Remember, people come over in wagon trains back in the 1800s and the like. Maybe go 2 or 3 miles an hour, and there were no roads. Maybe there might be some old rutty roads that other wagon trains have gone through, but there were no rest stops. There was nothing. And you had to provide for yourself 100% of the way. Many times, something about women having to leave everything behind. At first, they'd start with their old family clock and their big table and things. They were going to go to California or Oregon from somewhere on the East Coast. And as they went, it just became unrealistic to haul this heavy material, so they would just push it aside, throw it on the ground. Now, ladies, you know everything in your home is an extension of you. And so you're throwing a part of you down on the road, out on the prairie. And it wasn't uncommon for women to go crazy. They'd go mad as they got out into the wild prairies. Everything was opened up. The children were dying. They had to leave their homes and for some imaginary home thousands of miles away. And we're getting there at 2 miles an hour, if you're lucky. And you're losing everything. You lost your children. Maybe you've lost your mate. You've lost everything. And sometimes they just went crazy. We don't have that, but they had that journey they had to go through. So in times of pain, sorry, I didn't move that forward. So in times of pain, trial, uncertainty, and grief, we need to regain a sense of direction again. That's really what I'm trying to do today. I can't cover this huge subject in all of its dimensions in a short discussion, short sermon. But here again is Romans 8 from that from the Amplified Bible. We are assured and know that God, being a partner in our labor. This is just another way of putting it in this Amplified Bible, the classic version. All things work together and are fitting into a plan for good to those who love God and are called according to His design and purpose. Now, I quoted that verse one time to a lady, an elderly lady. God wasn't calling her, but she would come to church every now and again because she liked the people and she enjoyed the fellowship. And she was going through a trial, so I quoted that verse to her, but she didn't realize it was a verse. And I quoted, you know, all things work for the good of those who love the Lord. She says, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Because she sees it from a human perspective. She sees it from a human perspective. In our culture, in our society today, the aim of life is to be happy. Well, that isn't the way it is in real life. It's not, our purpose in life isn't to be happy. If we're happy, it's wonderful, and I hope we all are happy. But our purpose in life is to grow and develop. Mr. Armstrong used to call it holy, righteous character. The character of God developed that in us, more of His mind. Anyway, the next part, for those whom He foreknew, of whom He was aware and loved beforehand, God has determined that in each generation He would call people. He is destined from the beginning to be modeled into the image of His Son and share inwardly His likeness, character. And I really wish character would not be developed the way it is. But character is that way. It's something that changes us fundamentally because it's something that's not us. Holy, righteous character comes from God. Well, how do I get holy, righteous character when I'm in the mourning process? So hopefully we'll make that clear as we go through here. But one, remember, it's a journey of faith. It's a journey of faith. Go to the next one. Sorry. Never give me something electronic. Finishes the thought that He might become the firstborn among many brethren. And so Jesus was that. And those whom He has called or foreordained or predestined, foreordained, He has a plan. He's working out that plan. In each generation, He reaches out and calls certain people. And we don't know why, but he calls us, and we're thankful for that. He also called, and those whom He called, He also justified by the forgiving of our sins, or acquitted, made righteous, putting them into right standing with Himself. Even in grief, remember that. We see ourselves as sinners, which we are. We often see ourselves as slaves, which we're not. But we think like slaves. We're not slaves to sin, Romans 6:16. And those he's justified because we've accepted that sacrifice, he also glorified, raising them into a heavenly or spiritual dignity, as it says here, and condition of state of being. And we're in that state of being even when we're in mourning. You're a child of God, and you're a child of God in mourning. And God says, I understand that. How many times your child is crushed? And it's age appropriate, but your child is crushed. To them, it's just mammoth. And again, just I'm not trying to belittle our suffering. Draw the analogy. Our children are just this huge disaster has come. And you calm them and you talk to them and you help them through that process and they grow. Our one granddaughter, our oldest granddaughter, came to terms with death 2 weeks ago. Her dog died. And it was crushing to her. The first time she came in contact with death. So everybody, her papa, her grandma, and everybody she could think of who's in the family, she called and she was just weeping. Charlie died. Charlie died. Ah, shut up, get over it. It's a dog. Don't worry about it. Is that how we do it? No. This is an important moment. But you know what? I suggested to her, yep. And I'm sorry to hear that Charlie died. I had a dog and it died, but it helps me to always remember him, and that helps me to be happy. That's for a six-year-old. Okay? But there are those times when you just flat feel alone. And that's okay. It's part of the process. It's part of that process that you feel alone. And part of our job, if we are wanting to be a helper for them, you know, I hesitate to say counselor, but if you want to help folks who are in this state, again, don't lecture them. Well, what are you feeling alone for? You're a Christian. You have no reason to ever be depressed. I know someone who used to say that. As a Christian, you have no reason to be depressed or down about anything. Not like choking them in great love, but choking them. Yes, we mourn, but not as those who have no hope. We have the hope of the resurrection. And yes, that's something we cling to desperately when we're starting this mourning process. And it helps us. It's something we cling to, but if you're going to be there talking with people, don't lecture them. Just give them a hug. Sometimes just be there. That's all you have to do. Sometimes just be there, give them a hug. If they ask you something, it's almost like when you're first learning the truth and somebody asks you something, don't give them a dissertation. Just answer their question. A very simple, well, I know we're going to see them again, aren't we? And your response is, yes, we can be assured of that. Bing, no more. Let's go to Psalms 22. See if this sounds familiar to you in any way. Psalms 22. Now, when we were in Lubbock, my wife always had Kleenex in the living room because I tend to make women cry. I don't know why that is. So in case you need Kleenex, we did bring some boxes of Kleenex. So it's okay if you would raise your hand. And I can see Troy's crying, so let's get him some. Okay. But, it used to be sort of a joke, you know. The lady would say, you have Kleenex. We were ready. We knew you were coming, so here it is. But it kind of lightened up a tense moment. Psalms 22. I'm going to get there. Psalms 22, verse 1. My God, why have you abandoned me? Does that sound familiar? You find that in Mark 27, verse 46, Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus was quoting this psalm on the cross. When God took his spirit out of him so that he could be that sin offering, that pure sin offering, He felt the Spirit wasn't there, and he felt abandoned. People who are in deep grief feel abandoned. So what you do is run after them every 5 minutes, give them a call. How you doing? How you doing? How you doing? No. Maybe just a card every now and again. Thinking of you, praying for you, love you. If you ever need to call, you know, give me a buzz or whatever. Just something very simple. See, Jesus was on the cross and he was in agony. Emotional agony, physical agony. He knows what we go through. And none of us have gone through what he's gone through. Now, was he angry at the Father? No. But he felt, why have you abandoned me? Why have you forsaken me? And when we are in the middle of grief, sometimes we can just feel like, you know, I've tried to do what God wants me to do. I try to keep God's Ten Commandments. You know, I keep the holy days. I'm trying to do what's right. And then this happens, and where's God? And yet, back in our head, we're once again reminded, all things work for the good of those who are called according to his plan. And again, that holy, righteous character cannot be overestimated or overstated. Everything we go through, if we do it deliberately with intent, helps us to grow in that character. Many times when we ask, why did this happen? Really what we're asking is, why do I have to go through it? And so that's part of that being honest with one another and seeing that. Now it's interesting. Let's go now to chapter 28, verse 1 and 2 of Psalms. Chapter 28, verse 1 and 2. Lord, my rock. You see, one is, you know, God, why have you forsaken me? My God, why have you forsaken me? There's actually two different words there. One is Elohim and one is Yehovah, I think is how you pronounce that. Yehovah. And you also find that same principle found in Psalms 22, 1, verse 7, 1 and 7 we read. It's saying, God, the one true God. So it's making it very clear. God, the one true God. I call out to you for help. See in prayer, this is from David. Do not be deaf or silent to me. If you're silent, I'll be like those in the grave. I don't think I can survive this experience. Why was David writing this? Well, God is inspiring it to say to us, when we feel that way, it's part of the process we have to go through. And you're not a bad person. You're not a bad Christian. It's a process. And as you come out the other side, you'll see the strength in that character. Matthew 27, verse 46. I said what that was about, but let's take a look at that, where he says, he's saying, Elohim, Yehovah, I think is how you pronounce that again. And if you're into sacred names and you have another pronunciation, that's okay. I don't mean to sound terse, but I'm not interested in debating it, because I don't really know for sure. Anyway, and I don't think it matters. Anyway, so Matthew 27:46. We did have one fella in a congregation I used to pastor, and I really admired him. He believed in the sacred names, but he never said anything to anybody or tried to get others to agree with it. He just kept it to himself. That was his own conviction. That's fine. So anyway, I don't know why I'm saying that, but sometimes people with that notion of just, never mind. Matthew 27, verse 46. At noon, about the sixth hour, this is from the Expanded Bible, the whole country became dark. The land, the country around there, could be the whole city or the whole area of Judea, we don't know, but just that whole area became dark, and darkness lasted for 3 hours until about the ninth hour. About 3 o'clock, in the afternoon, which would be the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eli, Eli, Labashani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken or abandoned me? So here he is going through that process. So if you tell God in prayer, I feel like you've abandoned me. You have a high priest who's our advocate. You haven't sinned when you say that. You respectfully go to God and you say, I don't understand you. And that's because you're perfect and I'm far from it. What you allowed isn't what I would allow. But you're perfect and I'm not. But I still feel like you've abandoned me. And I know you haven't. But I feel that way. And I need you to help me through this process. Because I've learned that grief is a process. For that reason, conversion, the whole situation is a process we go through. So we see that Jesus was in a sense of grief, feeling alone. Something that is part and parcel of this whole process of being, going through grief. Let's go now to First Thessalonians 4. I want to make sure you see the screen. First Thessalonians 4. Verse 13. Again, from the expanded version. Brothers and sisters, why am I reading from the expanded version? I forgot my King James. So, brothers and sisters, we want you to know what's going on in Thessalonica at this point. People were just certain that Jesus Christ was going to return in their lifetime, that first generation. They were certain that was going to happen. Paul even said, we who are alive and remain will be caught up with him in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, and we will, okay, we know that. Later, Paul said, no. He says, my fight is finished. You know, I fought the good fight. And he knew he would be in that first resurrection. It didn't happen the way they thought. And what was happening is that people's faith was being shaken and some were losing their faith because Christ didn't come back when he was supposed to. We had people who have attended services with us just before the first Gulf War because they were certain that the church was going to flee. And so they wanted to be in church when we got the word to flee. And when the war came and gone, they left. Because that was the only reason, really, that they were there to start with. Anyway, others who start out strong, these kinds of things can happen. If we don't understand the process we're going through, it can destroy your faith. Brothers and sisters, we want you to know and do not want you to be uninformed about those Christians who have died, who sleep. That's a euphemism for death. So you will not be sad or grieved as others, we've read that part already, who have no hope. We believe that Jesus died and that he rose again. So through him, God will raise with Jesus those who have died. So God will bring with Jesus those who have died, fallen asleep, and so forth. He's just sort of expanding there. What we tell you now is the Lord's own message. We who are alive, still alive, when the Lord comes, again, when the Lord comes again, will not go before those who are already dead. The Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud commandant or shout, the voice of the archangel, and he quotes the various scriptures, and with the trump of God. And those who have died believing in Christ will be raised first. After that, we who are still alive and remain will be gathered up with them into the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And look what he says here. We will be with the Lord forever. And this is what I'm hoping we do today. So encourage or comfort each other with these words. So as a congregation, we're mourning the loss of Melissa and others who have died. We're mourning for so many that are sick right now. So many that are sick. It's a process we go through. But last week, I told you, last week was, I think, an important time. No matter how big or small a congregation is, it is a family. It is a family. And a family pulls together. Now, we live right next door to Brian and Amber. And Brian can't help it when he's wrong. But we still get to stay together, you know. He can't help it when he's wrong. So what I'm trying to point out, even in a family, we're not always going to agree with each other on things. But, you know, he just can't help it when he's wrong. But what a family does is you pull together and encourage one another. You pull together and you encourage one another, because that's what a family does. Even if you don't agree with each other on every little thing. A husband and wife don't agree on everything. Does anybody have a marriage where your wife and your husband agree on everything? If so, I want to talk to you and find out what your secret is. And again, Lisa can't help it when she's wrong. Okay. But a family pulls together. And I saw that last week. A large family coming together to mourn together, but also to celebrate a life that impacted so many people. In Little Lubbock, we did that. We had 30 people. We lost an elder. Then we lost an elder's wife. Then we lost several other leading members. And it's clobbering a little congregation. I mean, that is a major, major impact. But it pulls them even closer together. So that's one thing that God does, is he starts using these kind of events to pull us together. Little side arguments, little this, that, or the other, little thing we want to fuss about. Forget it. We're a family. We're here to hold each other, hug each other, and get through that process. And I saw that last week. So that aspect of it is very good and very healthy. Now let's pick up where did I leave off? Okay, comfort one another with these words. Now let's go to John 1. I'm sorry, John 11. John 11. We'll spend the rest of our time here in John, the 11th chapter. There's a lot of information in this chapter. More than meets the eye until you start looking at it. And at times it doesn't make sense. And other times it's confusing. And then when we kind of put it all together, you go, oh, okay. So let's look at John 11, verse 1. John 11, verse 1. A man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in the town of Jerusalem, Bethany, where Mary and his sister Martha lived. That's near Jerusalem, to the east of it, and so forth. Mary was the woman who would later put perfume on the Lord's feet and prepare him for his funeral. Now let's move down to verse 4. Verse 3. So Mary and Martha, Lazarus was sick, so Mary and Martha sent somebody, some servant, to go tell Jesus, quote, Lord, the one you love is sick. That's verse 3. Verse 4. When Jesus heard this, he jumped in the car and went right away to go and anoint and pray for the one that he loved who was sick. No, that isn't what he did. He said this odd statement. This sickness will not be in death, will not end in death. It is for the glory of God, to bring glory to the Son of God. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. He had a close relationship with that whole family. They somehow clicked, you know. But when he had heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed there where he was for 2 more days. That doesn't make a lick of sense. I believe it's about a 3-mile or 4-mile walk from where Lazarus was, from where Jesus was. You can look that up. So he could have done it. You walk an average of 3 miles an hour or so. You know, an hour or two, hour and a half, you'd be there. He waited 2 more days. Then Jesus said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. And his disciples said to him, are you nuts? That's not what it says, but it means. But teacher or rabbi, some people, they're the Jewish leaders, they're trying to stone you to death, and only a short time ago, now you want to go back there? So they totally missed the point that Jesus was waiting to go back to do something that was going to glorify God and glorify him. And no, they just heard the good news, we're not going. And we're staying right here because there have been attempts on his life and maybe on ours if we go back. Jesus answered, there are some 12 hours in a day. If anyone walks in by the daylight, he will not stumble because he can see by the world's light or the sun. But if anyone walks at night, he stumbles because there is no light in him to help him. Again, that's how this expanded translation says it. So what is he talking about? He's saying, when I'm here, I'm the light of the world. You'll find that in John 1, verse 1 through 4. He's called the light of the world. Chapter 9, verse 4. He says, you know, I am the light of the world. So he says, when I'm here, you're not going to have an untimely death. But you're going to die, but not by some human plot just to get rid of you. No, it would be according to God's plan. Okay? Verse 11. After Jesus had said this, he added, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to wake him up. Now, they're just totally confused. His disciples said, well, Lord, if he's only asleep, he'll be all right. You know, he'll sleep and get better. But Jesus meant that Lazarus was dead. I just thought he said he wasn't going to die and this wasn't a sickness unto death. What is he talking about? Is the Bible contradicting itself? But his followers thought that he meant Lazarus was really sleeping. So Jesus said to them plainly, duh, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes. Your friend that you love is dead and you're glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe. But let's go to him now. Believe what? We'll see. Then Thomas, the one called Didymus, meaning the twin, said to the other followers, here he is, as thick as wood, well, let's go that we can die with him. They just, boom, all going right over their heads. I'm the light of the world. As long as you're with me, nothing's going to happen untowards to you. I'm here doing what I need to be doing, da, 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 da. Boom, right over their head, right over their head. When Jesus arrived, verse 17, he learned that Lazarus had already been dead and in the tomb 4 days. So he'd been dead and in the tomb for 4 days. Why is that important? Why is that important? It was a tradition among the Pharisees, not the Sadducees, but among the Pharisees, that a good man, i.e. a good Pharisee, could possibly resurrect somebody who died between 1 and 3 days after they could be resurrected by a good man after 3 days, between 1, 2, and 3 days. But if the person's been dead for longer than 3 days, i.e. 4 days and longer, only the Messiah could resurrect him. Now, that's nonsense as far as their tradition, but that was their tradition. Jesus knew that tradition. And so he said, okay, we're going to wait till he's dead and in his grave for 4 days. Why 4 days? Because they had the belief. If you see a lot of these tombs, there's a picture of Mr. Armstrong by one of the tombs. Some suspect it may be where Jesus is buried, maybe not. Who knows? Doesn't really matter. There's that big, huge hole with a stone that rolls over it, and then there's a little hole above it. Well, that's where the soul, they teach, comes in and out for the first 3 days. So there's a soul that comes in, and if a righteous man happens to be there, then he'll resurrect. Of course, they have nobody's righteous enough to do that. But then the teaching is, by after 3 days, the body's become so decayed, the soul can't recognize the body anymore, and it leaves. And you're dead forever. Jesus knew this is all nonsense, but he knew that that's what they believed. And so he says, okay, according to your belief, the only one who can resurrect Lazarus is the Messiah. Stand aside. Roll the stone aside. And he says, Lazarus, come out. So, according to their tradition and their customs and their beliefs, at least the Pharisees, he just proved by their own belief system that he was the Messiah. What did they do? That's when they decided they were going to try to kill him and stop this thing. So that's part of this four-day business that's going on here. Now, Bethany's about 2 miles away, so there was just a very, like an hour walk. Many of the Jews who were in verse 19 who came to comfort Mary and Martha about their brother, because Mary and Martha are in grief. They're mourning. They're grieving. Now, sometimes, I don't know that this is the case here, but in ancient Israel, you could hire professional mourners. They would come and mourn with you. Sounds odd, but they do that. Now, I don't know if that's the case here. It may have just been genuine friends who were in mourning. When Martha, verse 20, heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." She's in grief and she's saying, "Why? Why did you let him die? You say you loved him and you sat on your can, put it in our day, and now he's been dead 4 days and he stinks. Why?" You think she's grieving? She's a woman of faith. So is her sister. We'll see that. "Lord, if you'd been here," last part of verse 22, "my brother would not have died." Now, verse 22. "But I know that even now God will give you anything you ask." See the faith she has? And Jesus said, "Your brother will rise again." Interesting comment she makes here. Martha answered, "I know that he'll rise again and live again in the resurrection on the last day." They believed in a physical resurrection, at least, again, the Pharisees. And she believed in that resurrection. She just said, "I know that in the last day he's going to be resurrected. But in the meantime, it's a long haul between that time." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection of the life." Now the lesson about why all of this has happened and transpired the way it has, we saw for the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he was, if you will, condemning them for their hardness of heart and not believing even their own traditions when he would resurrect Lazarus after 4 days. And now he's addressing himself to his followers. "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me will have life even if they die." Okay? "And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." So when will they never die? Well, when they're resurrected, they have the spirit body. "Do you believe this?" Martha answered, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the anointed, the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming to the world." You're the one who can fulfill all those promises. She knows her Bible. After Martha said this, she went and called to her sister Mary. And Martha said, "The teacher is here at long last," we might put in brackets, "and he's asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to Jesus. Jesus had not yet come to the town, but was still at a place where Martha had met him. The Jews were with Mary in the house, comforting or consoling her. It's a community effort here. "And when they saw her stand and leave quickly, they followed her, thinking that she was going to the tomb to" what? "Grieve, to weep, to anguish there. And Mary went to the place where Jesus was, when she saw him, she fell at her feet and said, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" See that thought, common theme. Where were you? And it's okay to ask that. You just, "Father, I don't understand. Where were you when this or that? When a child dies, or when we... fasted and we prayed and we did. Where were you? You just quiet and silent." David would speak about that in the Psalms. Anyway, he's asking, "Where were you?" When Jesus saw, verse 33, Mary weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, He was upset or disturbed in spirit. He wasn't sad that Lazarus was dead. He knew he was going to resurrect him. He was sad at their trauma that they were going through. He isn't cold and uncaring. Oh, yeah, you guys are crying. You're a bunch of babies. Man up here. He doesn't say that. He sort of, if you will, felt their pain. He also was probably wondering, when are they going to understand these things? So it was a mixture of all this. And he was deeply troubled, as it says here, or in his mind. He asked, where did you bury him? Come and see, Lord, they said. And Jesus wept, not because he had died, but because these people were so distraught, and he could identify with that. He felt for them. And he also had to be wondering, when are they going to get this in any deeper form? And this is why he's doing all these things here, to try to help them to get that deeper understanding. So the Jews said, see how much he loved him. But some of them said, well, if Jesus is who he claims to be, how come he can't resurrect his friend? How come he let his friend die? Well, if you think you're part of the true church and you guys pray and fast, you got a minister over there, anointed him with oil, and they died, so much for your church. Okay, so that's kind of how they were thinking. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, but Lord, it has been, there's that quotation, 4 days since he died. There will be a bad smell, a decomposition of his body. And Jesus said to her, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they moved the stone away, and then he said this prayer, Father, I thank you. Verse 41, Father, I thank you that you heard me. Total faith here he has, of course. I know that you always hear me, but I say these things out loud because of the people around me. He's praying out loud so that they would hear him talking to the Father. I want them to believe that you sent me. This is what he's verbally saying, and they're listening. After Jesus had said this, he cried out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out, or come forth. And the dead man came out, his hands and his feet wrapped in pieces of cloth, and how they did that, and they unwrap him. So there's a lot to this story here. A lot to this story here about mourning and unhappiness and grief. Going through that grief. But it's a normal process. Loss of a mate or a loved one, a parent, a child. Each person, and since this is talking about marriage in this book, each person in a marriage or in a family relationship, we can, you know, put that in there too. Each person in a marriage is involved in a beautiful tapestry. Ideally, each retains his own individuality and personality. The individual thread of our lives, emphasis mine, threads of our lives are visible, distinctive, and contribute to the strength of the relationship. That's true for a church. Every joint supplies. Remember? 1 Corinthians? Every joint supplies what is needed in the church. Grief is a process. Grief is a journey. Grief is real. Grief is okay. Grief is okay. I don't have time right now. We maybe do it later on. But you'll see in David's writings, there's a time he says, if I don't hear from you, I'm going to break. I need to hear from you. And God knows those things. Grief is a journey that we're on. Let's conclude by going back and reading what we started with. That is a journey of faith. Romans 8, verse 28 from the Amplified Bible with notes. And we know with great confidence that God, who is deeply concerned about us, causes all things to work together as a plan for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to his plan and purpose. So remember that it's a journey, and we're all individually on that journey, different place on that journey, but we're learning individually and as a congregation.